This is the Life Truth Network.
Quest for our Truth, Episode 342.
Quest for Truth, presented by Protectorate Productions and HPN, Helpsley Podcast Network. Now located at life-truth.com. And now, here is your host. Oh, come on. Do I really have to read this? Those world-famous ministers of goodwill, names you can trust, transparent before God and men to the point of being totally invisible, Keith Helpsley.
Welcome, everyone. This is your host, Keith, and it is time once again for Quest for Truth. Looks like I'm alone again here in Church House Studio. And it also looks like I have a bit of a background hum. I don't know if people can hear that or not, but I certainly can. It shows up in my pre-recorded segment, too, so I don't know. I'll have to see what's causing that and get rid of it. But hey, barring that, we've got some good content today. It runs a little bit long. I knew it would. So I'll keep things super short here and just say, hey, check out our webpage, life-truth.com. You'll find all of our shows we do, some sermon podcasts by Nathan Caldwell, and a few other things there. And we also are part of ChristianPodcastCommunity.org, a ministry of striving for eternity. So check them out, where you'll find a lot of great folks like these.
Are you just watching?
Do you enjoy watching movies?
The special effects, the interesting characters, the great stories.
There's a lot to enjoy that comes out of Hollywood. But sometimes it's best to approach secular media with a healthy dose of critical thinking.
Join me, E. Franklin.
And Tim Martin.
As we discuss our favorite movies.
And share critical thinking for the entertained Christian.
So visit areyoujustwatching.com to subscribe.
And don't just watch.
Ever wish you could get together with a friend over coffee each week and talk about God's Word? Me too. Hi, I'm Anthony Russo. I'm the host of Grace and Peace Radio. Grace and Peace Radio is a Christian living blog and podcast dedicated to engaging conversations about applying God's Word to everyday life. I hope you'll join me, Anthony Russo, on Grace and Peace Radio each week at graceandpeaceradio.com or right here on the ChristianPodcastCommunity.org.
Main topic.
Main topic.
Hey, we're going to be talking about the ninth commandment today. And just like I did before in the tenth commandment, I have some, a little bit I want to read out of a literal translation, basically just my notes out of looking through Hebrew text using Strong's Dictionary. It's very fun stuff. Tedious, but it can be fun. They want to look at what the scripture says about the topic of false witness, sometimes known as lying, but we'll stick with the term false witness for now. And finally, I have a statement. I won't read the scripture references because it'll take a long time, but we'll read a summary of what the Westminster Confession says on the topic to kind of wrap things up. So here we go. Let's start out with looking at literally what the ninth commandment says, which is found in Exodus 20:16. And the Hebrew is pretty straightforward. I won't read the Hebrew words because I'm not very good at that. But it comes out, if you was to do a word-for-word transliteration, bring it down, it's basically no heeding in a neighbor. Actually, the word neighbor, just that is a single word, but it does have a prefix that means in, and because it doesn't specifically have a suffix, that means you or your. You're talking about an individual, a neighbor, so this is why I wrote it down, in a neighbor. Or you could say against a neighbor, but moving on. Witness untrue. So one more time. No hating in a neighbor, a witness untrue. That's what the command reads. Now, more literally, or more, not literally, the way the NASB puts it, the New American Standard Bible, you shall not bear false witness against thy neighbor, or your neighbor, I guess it actually says. Again, the word your is really implied, and honestly, it doesn't really have that required suffix particle to really be your neighbor. It's more properly a neighbor. Another word I want to key in on is the word bear. What does it mean to bear false witness? Remember, in my literal notes, I use the word heed, H-E-E-D, heed. What does heed mean? It means, you know, to listen, to pay attention to, that kind of a thing. So what it's saying is, don't pay attention to a false witness against your neighbor or against a neighbor. In other words, if you know that something is a false witness and it's being said about somebody, it doesn't matter if it's your neighbor, a neighbor, any neighbor, you are not to pay attention to it. You're not to heed it. You're not to give it any weight. You're not to listen to any lies about your neighbor. It doesn't, now notice, it doesn't say you shall not lie to your neighbor. It doesn't say you shall not lie about your neighbor. Well, I guess it kind of does mean that. But lies are told. And it's just saying don't give it any weight. Don't pay attention to it. Okay. Now, I know that maybe throws a little bit of a monkey wrench into you shall not lie. But that's literally not what the command says. But let's look at some more on what the Bible says of thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. That's the King James statement. Various places in the law, it says it different ways. Exodus 23, verses 6 and 7. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. Verse 7, keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. So that's how that verse approaches false witness or lying. It says keep far from a false charge, so it's referring to in the legal realm. In verse 6 it says you shall not pervert justice in a lawsuit. So in other words, when it comes to a false witness, what this command is dealing with is when someone stands before a judge, he deserves due process without false witnesses. Because God will not acquit the wicked. You know, a man might be weak. A man might not know fully. But if an injustice is done and somebody serves punishment, God is the ultimate judge. He says, I will not acquit the wicked. In Leviticus 19, verse 11. Oh, and by the way, these verses I'm reading now are from the English Standard Version, kind of jumping around in versions just a little bit. In verse 11, you shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. So, there's right there. It does say that you shall not lie to one another. But look at what it's enjoined here with. Not to deal falsely. Again, that's a false testimony. Not to steal. So stealing, false witness, and lying are kind of bunched together in that the verse there. In Leviticus 19, verse 16, You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. So let's look at how lying is used there. You should slander. Slander is lying. You're telling an untruth about somebody. So slandering counts as lying, as does standing up against the life of your neighbor. You're giving a false witness against your neighbor. Why do you want to put your neighbor to death? And you know, this is right from I Am the Lord. In Deuteronomy 19:15, a single witness shall not suffice against a person, but any crime for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed, only on evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, shall a charge be established. In verse 16, if a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, verse 17, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, which before the priests and the judges, who are in office in those days. In verse 18, the judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, verse 19, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother, for you shall purge the evil from your midst. Verse 20, and the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit such evil among you. Verse 21, your eye shall not pity, it shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. And before I move on, let me go back. There's a lot to unpack with that. It takes more than one person, even from the smallest crime to the heaviest one that requires a death sentence. One person says so. It should never be a he said, she says kind of thing. Even for the slightest crime, there needs to be two or more witnesses to back it up. And this is a standard in how the law was practiced, even up to the time of Jesus, which we ought to get there before all done. And we can see how that worked out. But for any crime or any wrong, for any offense, but let me move down to verse 16 where it says, for if a malicious witness arises and it becomes evident he's a malicious witness to charge of a wrongdoing, then both parties, both of these witnesses, both parties, I suppose that means the accuser and the accused, will go before the Lord, or in this case really his representatives, the priest and judges. And once the judges have done their due process, give a fair shake, looked at both sides, are these guys lying? Are they colluding with one another, these false witnesses? If the witness is a false witness, then you shall do to that false witness what he wanted to do to the innocent man. Now just think about that. If someone was to bring me up on charges of murder and I didn't kill nobody, and it's proven that I didn't kill nobody, then the guy who is accusing me deserves my penalty, my death penalty, that I didn't do. Do you think that would stop a lot of false charges? It also says in there, I'm just going to find it, your eye shall not pity, in verse 21. In other words, the law needs to be dished out harshly, coldly, with a harsh hand. No excuses, no, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it. Once it becomes clear who did what, maybe the witnesses aren't false, but once it's time to punish, it needs to be done without pity. Get it done. It needs to be harsh for a reason, because it's to serve an example to prevent others from doing it. Now let's move on and look at maybe a bad example about lying. This involves Saul, King Saul. In 1 Samuel 22, starting at verse 8 through 19, verse 8, that all of you have conspired against me. No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. And let me, this all of verse 8, let me pause with that. Let me give you some background. I purposely kind of didn't, because this is King Saul speaking. And he has just perceived an injustice has been done. He has just perceived that his son-in-law, David, warrior champion of the nation of Israel, has flown the coop. He just taken off and went off on his own. And he found out that people knew about it and they didn't tell him. So were they lying to him? Was King David or Jonathan somehow, not King David, he wasn't king yet, was David or Jonathan somehow lying to him because they had this conspiracy going on? Is this a breach of the ninth commandment? In King Saul's eyes, yes, it certainly is. I'm going from his perspective right now. We'll maybe circle back on that in a little bit, but let's keep on going. Verse 9. Then answered Dob the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Verse 11. Then the king sent for the son of Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. The priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. Verse 12. And Saul said, Hear now, son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here I am, my lord. Verse 13. And Saul said to him, Why have you conspired against me? There's that concept of lying again. The king is accusing these priests. Even these priests are involved with lying to him about David's departure and cover-up of all that. He goes on. Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, and that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day? Verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king, And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Verse 15. Is today the first time I have inquired of God for him? No. Let not the king impute anything to his servant, or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little. Verse 16, and the king said, You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. Verse 17, and the king said to the guard who stood all about him, Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hands rest with David. Let me pause right there. Remember, this is all about a lie, or a perceived lie. The king felt he was being lied to because the people knew that David snuck away. They didn't tell him. This lie was exposed by Dob the Edomite, who is really a foreigner. An Edomite is not an Israelite. He was a foreigner who was attached to the army. Spilled the beans. And now he says, oh, even the priests are in on this. Call it together. I'm going to kill them all. Okay, people, turn to. Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David. And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But this, now, not disclosing it, if you know something and don't tell it, it's as good as lying to somebody. So when it comes to lying, we should be open up about it. If we know something, we should tell it. These are some lessons to be learned here. We're going to find out. This is why I said this is a bad example. If you don't already know, we'll keep on going. But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Verse 18, then the king said to Dob, you turn and strike the priests. And Dob the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. Verse 19, and Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep he put to the sword. Wow. So for the sake of lying, it was a massacre. It ended up with 85 people being killed over this lie. So this is the way that perpetuating a lie can carry, is it can end up with, in this case, 85 innocent priests and their families, wives, kids, and animals all being killed. Now, why is this a bad example? Okay, context time. Prior to this, of course, Saul had fallen out of favor with God, and David had been anointed as king, although he was still, as mentioned in his passage, David's captain of his guard. He was favored in his house. He was honored. He was trusted. There was no reason, absolutely no reason, for David to be suspected of doing anything dirty. There's no reason to suspect David would do anything other than be loyal. So why did the king think he was being disloyal? Why did the king think he was being lied to? Well, the king had been trying to kill David. He'd done it more than once. And David was fearing for his life, but he didn't know a good way to slip away and put some distance between himself. He'd finally put the situation to a test so that his best buddy in the whole world, Jonathan, the king's very own son, got it. He understood, oh my gosh, my dad's trying to kill this guy. He's my best friend. I don't want him to die. I need to help him put some distance here. So that's the setup. So was there a lie? Well, if you want to be honest about it, the king himself was being dishonest because he was trying to kill his number one man. And there was no lie if David was trying to do a little bit of self-preservation and distance himself. He didn't outright say, hey, kingy baby, it's time for me to go. You're trying to kill me. Call him out. He was at least respectful. David loved the king as much as he loved David. He was just as loyal. And so this perception that David did an unfaithful thing by lying is all in King Saul's mind. There was no loyalty. There was zero loyalty. How many witnesses did he call? Was it on the sake of only one? Or was there two or more? It's all in his own mind. There were no two witnesses. There were no three witnesses. It was just him accusing without any substance. So the lie was the king didn't want to confront the truth. Now, once David slipped away, did people know about it and didn't tell him? Yeah. When it became clear that David had help getting away by the priests, Was there people who knew who wasn't telling? Yeah, well, the priest didn't know, but in the words of the priest, this is not the first time we've went to the Lord on behalf of David. How did we know that this time was any different from any other time? If anything, they were just as misled as the king was, and yet being the tyrant that he had become, he chose to put them all to death. But you notice, what did his own soldiers do? They disobeyed, because this whole setup was based on a lie. It was based on King Saul's own lie. His own soldiers were not obligated to follow through on a command that's based on a lie that came from within the king's own paranoia head. So there are times when, say, a direct order can and should and rightly be disobeyed, not done. If a tyrant wants to kill somebody, all he needs is an excuse. He'll find a way. And in this case, hey, my own guys are disrespecting me and not doing it. I'll get this foreigner here, Dob the Edomite. And Edomites were off and on okay with Israel, but more often than not, they were enemies of Israel. They were on very tenuous terms. And so Ben Dob, hey, he didn't care. I'll go kill all these people for you. And he did. But it was based on a lie. And so I guess the questions here is there any time to ever tell a lie? Well, the priest didn't lie. The soldiers didn't lie. Maybe some, there was a cover-up. They maybe knew David slipped away, but maybe they didn't know why. Maybe they knew he'd slipped away, but they weren't privy to the lie. But how did they know they were supposed to tell the king? So maybe you can be exposed to a lie, and you're not obligated to say, you know, I saw something weird happening here. I don't know. But in this case, every step of the way that made things go from bad to worse, it's all the doings of King Saul's own imagination. And yes, it is right to disobey a lawful order if the lawful order is based on a lie. It's just not true. So let's move on to another abuse of the law, this time dealing with Jezebel. This refers to 1 Kings 21, verses, let's see, 10 through 13. Hey, I couldn't read the numbers there for some reason. I kept thinking it was 1 through 13. That's 10. So starting with verse 10. And set two worthless men opposite, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, "You have cursed God and the king." Then take him out and stone him to death. Verse 11. And the men of this city, the elders and the leaders who lived in this city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, as it was written in the letters that she had sent to them. In verse 12, they proclaimed a fast and set Nabob at the head of the people. Verse 13, and the two worthless men came in and sat opposite him, and the worthless men brought a charge against Nabob in the presence of the people, saying, "Nabob cursed God and the king." And so they took him outside of the city and stoned him to death with stones. Okay. There was two witnesses, and on their witness, they said Nabob lied, basically. He's disloyal to the king, and that really is all it takes, and he was stoned to death. That's the law being put into action. But again, this is a bad example, because context time. At this time, Nabob had a vineyard, and the king, Ahab, wanted it. Not for whatever reason, I'd have to go back and look it up. He wanted this vineyard. And Nabob said, "No, I'm not going to sell you the possession that's been in my family for generations. It's our family inheritance." No. And Ahab wanted to buy it, Bob said no. And he meaning King Ahab, went away and lied on his bed and whined and had a pity party. And Jezebel came in and says, "Hey, you're the king. Man up. Come on. You can deal with this." And when he didn't, she says, "I'll take care of it for you." And that's where it says in verse 10, to set two worthless men opposite him. Okay, so right off the bat, these two men, they're not good witnesses. They're telling false witness. It was a setup from the beginning. This is what it looks like when false witnesses are involved. And they brought this charge. Now, here's the thing is, the men of the city, the elders, the leaders of the city, they did as Jezebel sent word to them. Those leaders could have stood up and said no. But then again, did the leaders know that these two men were false witnesses? Because, let's see, go back up here. Yeah, it even says, set two worthless men opposite him. So in her letter to them, set two worthless men opposite him. The city's leaders knew that this is a setup. There's two worthless men. They knew there was false witnesses in their presence. They could have said no, but they probably were like, we don't care. What's Nabob to us? As long as it's not us getting killed. Yeah. But, of course, they went down just the way this happened. That they did as Jezebel had sent word. And just as she said, they proclaimed a fast. There's a setup for the reason why they're going to get Nabob in there. Set him at the head of the people. He's on the head table. He's on the man of the hour, all right? And then from there it goes downhill. These two false witnesses, these worthless men come in, and Nabob, I'm sure, didn't say a word. Maybe he has a mouthful of food at the feast, and suddenly these guys step up and say, "Did you hear that? He just said he cursed God and the king." And, of course, there are two witnesses, and the setup was there. And it was an unjust killing. Now, the way that the story ends up is, in the end, it doesn't go well, but it takes some more events. But there's an example of a bad king, a bad queen, bad government leaders who allow injustice to happen. And remember that verse before? God doesn't let give any heed to the unjust. God, in the end, will make sure that people are duly punished. If not in this world, you know it in the world to come. So let's look at some traits of the opposite of a liar. We talked about what the law said and some bad examples there. This is really quick in Psalms 15:3. Who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend? Psalm 101:5 through 7. Whoever slanders his neighbor secretly, I will destroy. Whoever has a haughty look and an arrogant heart, I will not endure. Verse 6, I will look with favor on the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He who walks in the way of the blameless shall minister to me. Verse 7, no one who practices deceit shall dwell in my house. No one who utters lies shall continue before my eyes. Proverbs 10:18. The one who conceals hatred has lying lips, and whoever utters slander is a fool. Proverbs 11:13. Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps the thing covered. Now, I want to move on to the New Testament. Before I do, that last verse kind of nails another topic here. Is there ever a time to tell a lie? Whoever goes about slandering reveals secrets. Is it ever okay to reveal a secret? Can revealing a secret ever be a slander? I know who stole the balloons from your shelf there, Grandma. It was him. Well, you're revealing a secret, and maybe justly so. But whenever you say it was him, maybe it wasn't him. Maybe it was somebody else. But if you was to reveal a secret and say it was that guy, and you thought it was that guy that's slandering that guy, maybe he didn't know it seemed. Maybe he just think of a way to get him in trouble. Okay. But he who is trustworthy in spirit keeps a thing covered. Do you know a secret about a best friend? Is there some secrets about a best friend that you just wouldn't tell in public? I've been married for a long time. I probably know some secrets about my wife that I'm going to be totally honest because it says not to keep any secrets. But would it be hurtful? Would I lose my trustworthiness if I was to share something? Is there ever a time to withhold a secret? Remember the King Saul? He was upset with his people because they withheld information from him. Is there ever a time to, I'm using air quotes, lie? Well, if it's going to be hurtful, if it's going to be slanderous, then there's no obligation to tell something. So yeah, there is a time to at least avoid, either avoid the lie or avoid an embarrassing thing. You know, honey, does this dress make me look fat? Well, every husband that's ever been married for all much of a time knows that not to answer that. And honestly, there are maybe a couple ways. I mean, you could say, you know, are you trying to trap me into saying something that I shouldn't? And not that you're trying to say yes or no on that, but maybe it lets your wife know that don't set me up because whatever I say is going to hurt your feelings. It would, usually. Or you could just say, you know, the dress is just fine, whatever. But anyway, there are times to be diplomatic and withhold for the sake of not slandering and for the sake of keeping trust. Let's real quick move into the New Testament. This shouldn't take very long. Because in Matthew 26:59, now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death. Verse 60, but they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last two came forward, and we'll stop right there because we know how that ends up. So here, you know, you can't put someone to death without two witnesses, and they purposely sought false witnesses. So they were outright breaking the law when it comes to false representation, false witnesses. They were outright purposely trying to tell a lie to put him to death. Let's look at Acts 6:13. And they set up false witnesses who said, this man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law. And of course, again, they're trying to set up the disciples at this point. I forget which ones. Let's see if it's going to be Acts 6. It's probably going to be Peter and his fellow disciples are trying to say, these guys are stirring things up. They're disregarding the temple. But they had to seek false witnesses if they wanted those charges to stick. And this is coming from the top dogs in the religion, the religious leaders. They should know better. Let's look at Ephesians 4:31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Now, did you notice the grouping of sins there? Malice, clander, clamor, slander, bitterness, wrath, anger. And this is all in regards to false witness and lying. You know, malice is just that. You purposely got an axe to grind with somebody. 1 Timothy 1:10, the sexually immoral, the men who practice sexual immorality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. Again, notice the list. Notice the grouping that liars is put in amongst. It's not a good company. Enslavers, perjurers, sexually immoral. Let's see, moving on to 1 Timothy 2, verse 3. Heartless, unappeasable, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, not loving good. Again, look at that grouping of sins. This is the crowd you keep when you're among people who are liars or false witness. And we'll wrap up here. I almost didn't want to share this verse, but let me do it anyway. In James 4:11, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. Good advice. The one who speaks against a brother or judges a brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. And that last bit is, to me, was confusing. What does that mean? That if you speak against a brother or judge a brother, that you're speaking evil against the law. What does that mean? You judge the law. So that, I mean, if you judge the law, you're not someone who does it. You become somebody who judges over it. And the more I thought about this, I was reminded of a mental picture. I think I might have used it on the podcast a long time ago. But if you think of a game of tennis, you have people who are in the game. You are a doer in that tennis game. Of course, tennis has certain rules to follow. You have to stay within the boundaries of the court. The ball goes back and forth over the net. And other rules. Well, the judge is not on the court. The judge is not a doer in the game. A judge sits on this big old high stool, 6 feet off the ground, looking over the tennis court for the best vantage point, not in the game, outside the game. But because he is above the game, he can judge, oh, the ball went out of bounds, oh, he didn't make the net, oh, he did this wrong. He's not in the game, so therefore he holds a higher position and is qualified to judge the rules, the law, and the game. So if you want to make yourself out to be judge, you're not in the court. You're busy judging. And not that judges aren't important, but you have to understand, are you going to be a doer or a judge? And if you're going to be a doer, let's go back up to this first line. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. Let's move on. I said I would wrap up with reading quickly from how the Westminster Confession deals with this command. It's interesting in that it breaks it down into duties that are required for us to meet this command, and is And there's like 20 some odd things that it lists out. And some of them will sound familiar as I zoom through this. And then it talks about things that are sins that also relate to this. So, and there's about 40 of them. So let me zoom through this pretty quick here. It has to do with preserving truth between man and man, or you know, amongst one another, and the good name of our neighbor as well as our own. It's about good names, appearing and standing for the truth. If we're not going to be lying or false representing, we should definitely be for the truth. It should be from the heart, sincere, freely, clearly, and fully, speaking the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice, in all other things whatsoever, it's charitable esteem of our neighbors, loving, desiring, rejoicing in their good name, sorrowing for and covering up their infirmities, freely acknowledging their gifts and graces, defending their innocence, readily receiving a good report, and unwilling to admit an evil report. Now, if they deserve an evil report, then accept that. If they don't deserve a good report, then be willing to do that. But we have to give them the benefit of the doubt and be eager to hear a good word about them and be unwilling to hear the evil word. We should discourage talebearers, you know, tattletales. We should, to continue the list, discouraging flatterers, slanderers. We should love and care for our own good name and defend it when required. We should keep lawful promises. We should study and practice whatever is true, honest, loving, and whatever is a good report. A lot of stuff there, but you can see basically to be a non-liar, we'll call it, to the duties that we should hold, very positive. It all involves around telling the truth, being truthful, being honest. And of course, the sins that are forbidden, this is a longer list. we shouldn't prejudice the truth or the name of our neighbors, especially in public judicature, in other words, the legal system. We shouldn't give false evidence or supporting false witnesses. We shouldn't knowingly appeal for and pleading for an evil cause. We shouldn't pass unjust sentence, calling evil good and good evil, rewarding the wicked according to the work of the righteous and the righteous according to the wicked's work. There should be no forgery, concealing the truth, and holding our peace when iniquity calls for reproof of ourselves. Wow. So if someone is chewing your butt because you did something wrong, hold your tongue. Hold your tongue. Let them get it all out. Let's see. Speak the truth unseasonably. Remember I said there's a time you should not tell a secret if it's going to be hurtful to a friend and lose that trustworthiness. We should, if it ends in a malicious or wrong end, if it perverts a wrong meaning, if it's doubtful or equivocal expressions, we shouldn't speak in untruth, we shouldn't lie, slander, backbite, detract, talebearing, I thought we already said that one, whispering, scoffing, that means making fun of or mocking, reviling, that means making somebody out to be a villain, rash, harsh, impartial, censuring, misconstructing intentions, words, or actions. In other words, don't put words in people's mouths. Flattering, I said that one already. Vainglorious, boasting, thinking too highly of ourselves or others, and denying the gifts and graces of God, aggravating smaller faults. Don't make mountains out of molehills. Hiding, excusing, or extenuating sins when called to confess. In other words, as harsh as it is, did you do it? Yeah, I kind of did. Unnecessary discovery of infirmities, that goes again to not telling secrets to hurt somebody. Raising false rumors. If you hear somebody spreading some gossip, you can say, put your hand up, nope, stop. You know, where'd you hear this from? Well, I heard it from someone who heard it from someone. It's like, well, let's let it stop here because you really don't know, and I don't want to hear it. But don't receive or countenance evil reports. In other words, don't receive or stand for those evil reports to spread. And it goes on not to envying or desire. We shouldn't rejoice in someone else's disgrace or infirmity, which means sickness or weakness. We shouldn't have scornful contempt. And it goes on a little bit longer, but wow, it kind of repeats some of it there. But that kind of summarizes a lot of those verses shared. And I know this has gone on just a bit long. I knew it would. But that's what I wanted to share about lying.
Striving for Eternity is a Christ-centered ministry focused on equipping people for eternity, and they provide speakers and seminars that come to your church with expertise in theology, hermeneutics, world religions, creation science, evangelism, presuppositional apologetics, church history, and expertise in sexual abuse in the church. For details on their seminars and to request a speaker for your church, go to strivingforeternity.org. Striving to make today an eternal day for the glory of God.
Welcome to the Blue Stocking Baptist Podcast. My name is Hannah Oliver, and I'm here with my co-host, Esther Faulkner. Esther and I are both particular Baptists who hold to the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith. The Blue Stocking Baptist Podcast is an informal podcast for women with intelligent and literary interests related to Christian doctrine and life. Esther and I both have a passion to see unbelievers come to the faith, and so we hope our material will be used for the furtherance of God's kingdom. You can email us at thebluestockingbaptists@gmail.com or find us on Facebook at The Blue Stocking Baptists or on Twitter at She Baptists. Thank you so much, and God bless, guys.